We move to the next case of the morning, which was the Gregory Koger v. Walter Ryan et al. Mr. Oldham.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. My name is Jeff Oldham, and I was appointed on behalf of Appellant Gregory Koger in this case. In this case, Your Honors, defendants repeatedly denied Mr. Koger's requests for a non-meat diet and to have his religious affiliation changed while he was at the Pontiac Correctional Center. This was a diet that the Pontiac Correctional Center already offered. The only two reasons that defendants ever gave to Mr. Koger in denying his request, and both reasons are consistent with IDOC policy on these issues, are first, their clergy verification requirement, and second, their required practices rule. Until the case reached this court, defendants had justified one or the other of the rationales as either reasonable or the least restrictive means under the Free Exercise Clause or RLUIPA. In this court, the defendants have apparently stopped defending either one of those justifications because both are plainly impermissible under RLUIPA or the First Amendment or both. And instead, they've moved to previously unmentioned arguments challenging the religiosity of Mr. Koger's requests or beliefs and trying to defend the case based on policies that they never applied to him in this case.
I thought the critical part of this case, and correct me if I'm wrong, is whether this restricted diet is an essential part of this new religion that he's found. I mean, he jumped around. He was a Baptist, then a Buddhist, and now he's whatever this one is, Mr. Greenfield's religion.
Respectfully, Your Honor, I disagree that that's the issue in this case. Under RLUIPA, in fact, the court cannot ask whether it's essential to his religious beliefs. RLUIPA makes abundantly clear that the inquiry is not whether a practice is central to or compelled by his religion. That can't be the question under RLUIPA. Similarly, under the Free Exercise Clause, it's clearly established law in the Supreme Court and in the circuits that whether a particular practice is mandatory or obligatory within his religion dictates whether or not he's protected under the Free Exercise Clause. The analysis is simply whether he sincerely holds the belief and whether the belief is religious. That's the threshold question under both RLUIPA and the Free Exercise Clause.
Well, the question of whether this special diet, the vegetarian diet, is important to the religious practices of your client does go to whether the restriction that was imposed, which was that you got to verify that, is a burden.
Well, under RLUIPA, there's a question of whether it is a substantial burden to his religious exercise. Respectfully, the correct analysis, I think, under the substantial burden test is just how substantial the burden is on his exercise. If the question becomes how substantial this practice is to his religion, then that runs again, you know, very much in tension with RLUIPA's other provision saying that the courts can't inquire into the centrality of a practice. So the question is how substantial the burden is on his practice. Now, some courts have found that there is another threshold requirement that you have to look at how important it is, doing so with the recognition that the importance or significance of the practice can't run afoul of RLUIPA's, you know, plain statement that you can't look into centrality. And under, you know, the importantness of the practice, that's again something that was never challenged below, was never challenged in the district court at all, and it was never actually imposed on Mr. Koger in the facts. He was always asked to provide a letter from a clergy member vouching for his affiliation and vouching for the fact that it's a required part of his religion. So again, this is something that's waived and not before this court. But there is evidence in the record that this diet is important to his practice. I think it's easy to see from the record as it's currently shaped that he's testified in a sworn affidavit that this was part of his religious practices. For years now, he's tried to abide by a religious diet, even not having been provided one, enduring severe hunger. He's actually felt compelled, because of the rules that defendants have opposed, the clergy verification requirement, he's felt compelled to go and find an official organization that's consistent with his beliefs that will recognize this practice. I think all those things go to and speak to how important this is to his religious beliefs. And I think you can tell from the circumstances, you know, this court has made very clear that prisoners have a right to adequate nutrition that's consistent with their religious beliefs. And it's a very commonly practice and commonly recognized form of spiritual discipline for all sorts of religionists, and in particular OTO members. The documentation you provided says that it's a that some OTO members do engage in a dietary practice as part of their spiritual discipline. And so I think there is evidence on the record that shows that this is an important part of his beliefs. But again, I would just reiterate, this was something that was never challenged until this appeal. And so so it's not properly before this court.
Well, and it seems to me it's implicit in the IDOC regulations, though. And these regulations, I think, are fairly routine in prison systems around the country, that if you want a religious accommodation, you've got to fill out a form and say what your religion is and verify it before there's going to be an accommodation of that, as in a special diet or services of some sort at the prison, etc. These regulations and requirements are fairly routine, and I'm having a hard time seeing the substantiality of the burden. Put it that way.
Sure. Absolutely. It's absolutely routine and understandable and reasonable, and no one can argue with the fact that prisons have to be able to require some verification from prisoners before they go and they get special benefits, before they get, you know, their religion changed, before they get other things. And that's the way defendants defend this case on appeal. The problem with this case is that's not what defendants did. They required a lot more than some verification. Consistent with their regulations, they actually asked for him to be able to get it. They said that he had to show that it was a required practice. They didn't just say that it had to be important. They said, we won't give this diet to you because the documentation you provided to us suggests it's a permissive practice, and therefore it's not required. The Illinois regulation actually, in fact, is consistent with that and says that in order to get something, you have to show that it's required. And the point is that that's plainly impermissible under RLUIPA and the Free Exercise Clause. Under both those provisions, it's clearly established law that something does not have to be mandatory in one's faith in order to receive protection.
Well, in what sense is it a burden if it's not mandatory?
I'm sorry?
In what sense is the requirement of a requirement a mm-hmm. burden? There's a disconnect here.
Well,
if a practice is not required by the petitioner's religion, mm-hmm. then in what sense is he being burdened?
Well, I think you can think of examples in all kinds of religions that are not, strictly speaking, a requirement of that religion. For example, the sacrament and for Catholics and having wine. That is not, strictly speaking, necessarily a requirement, but it's something that is commonly practiced. And you can, you know, across religions, you can think of a lot of different examples of practices for Buddhists. And Buddhists are commonly recognized to have non-meat diets. Is it something that is required? Absolutely not. Is it something that a great many of them feel in their own, you know, in their own conscience and religious conscience is something that they need to follow as part of a, you know, spiritual discipline? Absolutely. And so I think what the Supreme Court has recognized and what all the other circuits to address this have recognized in the context of the required practices rule is that it goes way too far, because it would actually prevent a number of inmates or a number of just petitioners generally from receiving protection under the Free Exercise Clause or RLUIPA for practices that are very common, that they feel are very important, but they can't point to a scripture and say, see, here is where it's required by my religion. It just goes way too far, and it's not only impermissible under the First Amendment and RLUIPA, it's a very substantial burden. If you cannot, in this case, if you don't belong to an organized religion that has a clergy member that can vouch for the fact that it is required by the religion writ large, you cannot get a religious diet in Pontiac.
Let me back you up just a minute. As I understand it, he really doesn't have organized religion. These are personal religious beliefs, and you think he's being forced to identify with a religion that may coincide with his dietary beliefs. He otherwise wouldn't join a religion.
Well, no, I think the argument is that as part of his religious beliefs,
personal he needs religious beliefs.
I'm sorry.
Personal.
Yeah, initially when this case, when he first moved to Pontiac, he requested a religious diet as part of his own personal beliefs. He wanted to be changed. He no longer wanted to be associated with Buddhism, and so he changed that religion and also asked for a non-meat diet. He was told he could only get a non-meat diet if he had a letter from the religious leader of his church saying that it was required. Naturally, he then understood that he was never going to be able to get one unless he was part of an organized religion that had a religious
leader. So he's basically looking for a religion that coincides with his personal religious belief when it comes to diet.
I think yes, in the sense that then what he did was he went to search for a religion that would be consistent with his own personal religious beliefs. And I don't think that's something that one can say goes to his insincerity. You know, for example,
I'm looking at his. I want to just focus. This is his personal religious belief. Now, is that enough?
I think it's certainly under this court's case law, where it's found that atheism is a religion, and it's defined religion in a very functional way to say, does that person's religion operate in that person's life and deal with ultimate issues the way Christianity or the way Catholicism would in another person's life?
Under that, and their case law or whatever statute is the standard under RLUIPA easier for him than under the Free Exercise Clause? Is there a distinction in the standard?
RLUIPA puts a much higher burden on the government to prevail because their interest has to not just be legitimate, it has to be compelling, and their means have to not just be reasonable, they have to be the least restrictive means possible. And so certainly RLUIPA is his stronger claim in the sense of the standards that the government has to meet. I think even under the lower standards, he can meet the test to show that they provided no evidence whatsoever on how legitimate their interests here are in denying a meal that they already offered to a prisoner who's requesting it.
Lower standard under the Free Exercise Clause. Go ahead.
Correct. But if your question is why both claims are being pursued, it's that there might be individual defenses that individual defendants might make to each, and so both claims are
valid. Get back to a little common sense in this case, if I can. He is out right now. He's not in custody anymore.
Correct.
So all these requests for injunctive relief are moot. So all you're left with, if you win this case, is to go back and have a trial, a damage action in a courtroom to determine, in a district court, to determine what damages should be paid to him for this violation. And I just have a hard time seeing that there's much merit to something like that. And I mean, I appreciate greatly Mayor Brown's terrific work on this case, Mr. Kadish, and, you know, especially after representing the downtrodden like Ameritech and Chevy Chase Bank in the first two cases we had today. But to take this case, it's a wonderful service you do for the court. But are you guys going to want to stick around and try this case if you're successful and go in front of a jury and ask for damages here?
And, Your Honor, I'd like to reserve some time for rebuttal, but to answer your question, I don't think the fact of what damage he might be able to get for this case is really relevant to the merits of his RLUIPA and First Amendment claims. You know, they've applied two different standards to deny him what he wanted when he was in prison that are plainly impermissible under RLUIPA and the First Amendment. And the larger point, I think, is that these are IDOC policy. These are policies that they're applying to all kinds of prisoners. And so I think for that reason, too, this is not just an insignificant case that this, you know, that the court would want to look to the next step. These are policies they're applying. But for his case, yes, absolutely. He still has claims for damages that are live, and he's entitled to go back and try these issues and actually get the defendants to be held accountable for their actions. Thank you. I'll reserve the rest of my time.
Okay. Mr. Barov.
May it please the court, Brian Barov, Assistant Attorney General, on behalf of the defendants and appellees in this case. Listening to Mr. Oldham's argument and the questions from the court, it seems to me there's very little difference here on our interpretation of the law. I think we agree that prison officials have the right and the obligation under the First Amendment to make a distinction between those accommodations prisoner seeks which are genuinely rooted in the prisoner's own individual religious beliefs. This isn't to say that the Department of Corrections wouldn't recognize and accommodate a religion of one, just like it will accommodate a religion of 1 million or 10,000. We respect idiosyncratic and minority religious beliefs under the First Amendment, but we do have to verify the religiosity of the claim. And that's where...
Well, it seems like the need to verify gets more important if the burden on the prison is great. But here, to give somebody a non-meat diet, I assume there's a number of prisoners that have a vegetarian diet in prison. I don't see that this is a great... skin off your nose at the prison to have to give this guy, you know, macaroni and cheese or something instead of a hamburger.
Certainly, Your Honor, and we're not defending it on the cost of the individual meal to this individual plaintiff. In fact, at the time, I believe the record reflects that as of 2004, there were something like 32 prisoners in Pontiac already receiving vegan meals. One other was receiving a vegetarian meal. So the burden on the prison is not so much... in this case, is not the individual cost to the individual plaintiff. But we do have 45,000 mouths to feed across the prison system. And if a prisoner can stand up and say, and simply assert sort of a conclusory religious belief as a basis for a vegetarian meal sort of at his whim, then that does have the potential to throw the prison administration of diet into chaos. And remember, prisons aren't like, you know, I'm trying to think of another similar institution, a Big Ten university. We're not offering, we don't have the ability to offer individual meals to individual, you know, prisoners. There's basically your standard meal plan, and there's going to be the religious accommodations that are met. So for prisoners to say, I want a religious meal just simply because this is my religious belief, that does have a potential.
I'm not asking for some bizarre kind of, this is...
No, not...
Starting off
not,
the menu at Chez Panisse or something. This is... Just doesn't want to have a
certainly
meat,
certainly
know.
and but again, under the First Amendment, you know, and I think the Supreme Court made this very clear in Wisconsin versus Yoder, there's a distinction between those desires. The First Amendment protects religiously rooted desires, not those that are based on secular or philosophical reasons. And so the prison, in order to accommodate individual prisoners' religious beliefs, has to be able to make that distinction. Is this genuinely a religious belief, and is this rooted in a health reason? Is it rooted in a secular philosophical reason? And regardless of the substantiality of the burden, that goes to the sort of second part of the test of the weighing test under the Ohlone Turner standard. The threshold determination has to be met first.
Well, I understand that right. You have to that's a sequential order that we go through.
Right.
We don't get this. But it seems to me that prison could have avoided all this litigation. So you want a vegetarian meal? Just join these other 32 people and get one. We'll give it to you.
But
we're not going to let you change back, you know, a week after this if you've got a hunger for a filet mignon or something.
Well, the problem is if we give it to one, then if we apply that standard to one, then we have to apply that standard to everybody.
Well, and realistically, I don't know much about prison food, except it probably is not great. And I wonder how many people, for reasons other than religion, would want a vegetarian diet. Now, maybe you can say because they're, you know, I imagine most folks in prison want to get as much food as they can eat. I don't know what goes on. I really don't know. But it does seem that is not... There's not going to be a long line at the vegetarian counter.
Granted, Your Honor, and we're not expecting people necessarily storming the vegetarian line. That isn't, again, the particular cost of the meals in and of themselves is not...
I'm not even looking at the cost. I'm looking at just what somebody may want to eat. Maybe they're hungry and they'd rather have some meat or something. Look, I have, in my own family, I have people who have a little nuance about what they eat and what they don't eat, and I recognize that can be a problem, but I don't see... All he has to do is just declare this is his sincere religious belief, which apparently it is. He's meandering around trying to find a religion that will accommodate him, at least under the free exercise clause. I think RAUPA, whatever you pronounce that acronym, is a little more difficult than you're saying. It looks like the statute just pretty much says you got to do it unless there's a real good reason not to.
Correct. But I think, again, the problem goes back to what you said in your comments is Mr. Kocher has never tied in his desire for a vegetarian diet to his religious belief, and that's the ultimate failing in his case. In his response to his statement of undisputed facts in response to the motion for summary judgment, he said this repeatedly, and he's had opportunity to expand on this, which he hasn't, that his desire for a vegetarian diet is tied to his yoga practice. But he's never said, given a reason tying this into a particular religious belief, and until he can do, and it isn't a substantial burden for him to do so.
Is it unfair to claim yoga is a religion?
It might very well be. You know, if he can tie it into a religion, a religious belief. I mean, certainly, as the case law has shown, and I think that vegetarianism is a recognized practice in Buddhism. Yoga is one of the practices in Buddhism. So if he could tie all this together, perhaps he could. But he's never done it, and he's never even done it in this court. And the thing is, we're beyond sort of the question of what did he tell the prison officials. He's brought a suit in court, and he's responding to a motion for summary judgment. And in the motion for summary judgment, the role of the court is to look and say, is there anything worth trying here? Are there any facts worth trying here? And he's had the opportunity to come forward and explain his religious beliefs to the court, and he has never done that. And I think as Judge Seitz said, implicit in our arguments below that he verify his religious beliefs is the argument that he's never met this threshold requirement. And there's no prejudice to him because he has had the opportunity to do that. And he's never, and even before we get into the question of how much would it cost to provide a vegetarian meal, how much is this going to cost the prison system, what's the burden on the prison system, there's still this threshold requirement that he's never met in this case. And that's really the ultimate failing in this case.
A little off base, but is there a caloric requirement that you've got to have a certain number of calories in a meal? How do you vegetarian versus meat?
I believe there are both caloric requirements and nutritional requirements. There's a staff nutritionist to make sure everybody's getting the right balanced diet.
Okay.
And that can be done through vegetarian means.
There are two regulations at issue here that were invoked by the prison to
Correct.
Deny his request. The first one was the clergy verification that,
right.
you know, in order to,
right.
to change your designated religion, you've got to submit something from a representative of your religion.
Right.
And then the second is the rule governing special diets, which requires that the special diet be required by
right.
the religion. Does the second of those regulations withstand scrutiny under RLUIPA?
Well, I guess the answer is probably no. I mean, we didn't apply these regulations directly. We weren't really applying these regulations directly in this case. The regulations don't comport with the standard. It's not that they comport with RLUIPA. The required practices doesn't accord with this whole line of case law involving the First Amendment and RLUIPA.
You're conceding that the second regulation is a violation of RLUIPA?
No. What I'm suggesting is the second regulation, which was drafted some 10 years ago, doesn't necessarily comport with the current standards of the law. We weren't applying the regulation directly. We weren't actually applying the regulation, you know, the way regulation is written. The practice was when they sent this letter, they said, you know, it was a sort of shorthand. Give us something from a clergy, rabbi, imam, etc. Give us something from, as the regulation actually refers to, religious representative. That's what they meant. Give us something from a religious representative. That can be you if you're the religious representative. Now, as to the required practices prong, admittedly, this again wasn't, you know, well articulated. They're not lawyer. The assistant warden is not a lawyer, and maybe, you know, they didn't articulate their rationale correctly. But again, implicit in the denial is, give us something to substantiate your religion. Give us something to verify that.
The vegetarian meal was denied based on the representation from I think clergy is probably the wrong word, but the representative of this OTO faith that the vegetarian diet was not a requirement of the faith, but was permissive. Wasn't that the basis that he was denied ultimately?
This is what the assistant warden said. See, the information I reviewed regarding this religious indicates there are no dietary requirements.
So that that follows the regulation that you've just conceded is a violation
but I've come close to conceding,
a violation of RLUIPA.
What I'm suggesting is that there's more to this, the denial, than simply saying it wasn't a requirement of that religion. It was not there was nothing in here showing that it was part of that religion, and you've seen there's nothing in here showing that it's part of your practice of OTO. So since if he could have shown that part of his OTO practice, whether it was required or not by OTO, demanded or, you know, he wanted this vegetarian to comport with some important OTO practice or his interpretation of OTO practice, he could have gotten the vegetarian diet. That's basically what the basis of the denial was. In any case, so it's our position that there was, regardless of whether, how well drafted the regulations are, how well articulated they were articulated in this case, the fact is he's never met the religiosity requirement, and there was no violation of either RLUIPA or the First Amendment in why his vegetarian request was denied.
Is the regulation being updated?
I don't know, Your Honor. But it isn't being applied as it's written. Let me put it that way. Thank you. And we'd ask the district court's decision be affirmed.
Okay. Mr. Oldham, you've got about a minute.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just a few points in the limited time I have. The first point is defendants, again, are now defending this case based on the fact that he apparently didn't satisfy them that his beliefs and requests were rooted in religion. They never asked him that below. They asked him for two things, clergy verification, and then they faulted him for the documents he did provide, saying that they were not required by his religion. That's all they ever asked, and they did not ask him to explain his beliefs in more detail. So that's why it's waived on appeal to come now and argue that point. They never moved for summary judgment on the issue. Quickly, the state says that they were not actually applying the regulations in this case. As Judge Sykes pointed out, the letter from Ms. Jordan Luster actually says that it was not a dietary requirement, that they applied the required practices rule here. The clergy verification rule was applied throughout this case. If you look at the motions to dismiss and the motions for summary judgment, you'll see that on motion to dismiss initially, the only basis on which the lawyers representing the defendants in this case defended themselves was on the required practices rule. If you look at the motion for summary judgment, the only basis on which they defended themselves was the clergy verification requirement. That is the policy that was applied in this case, and you can look at other cases like the Agrawal series of unpublished district court opinions that were cited in the briefs to see that they are applying these rules, and regardless of how they're saying in this case how they're applying them, you can look at the regulations. Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay. Thanks to both counsel and to you, Mr. Oldham, for you and your firm for taking the assignment. A very good job of putting forth what sometimes there are obscure sources, and we end up with a major case from a prisoner. So thanks. Thanks to both counsel. This case will be taken under advisement.